Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Donald Trump inflaming the combustible situation with North Korea with name-calling and threats that play to his base but could ignite a catastrophic war. Norman Ornstein, a contributing writer for The Atlantic and co-author of It's Even Worse Than It Was, whose forthcoming book is One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported, joins us. We will discuss whether there is a method to Trump's madness in continually riling up his base with overheated attacks on his enemies while constructing an alternative reality via propaganda pumped out by Fox News and Sinclair. In addition to unlimited financial backing from billionaires and ongoing efforts to suppress the vote, would this be enough to keep him in power, particularly as long as the Democrats fail to exhibit leadership and offer a narrative beyond Trump is a disaster and if you vote for him, you're an idiot, a refrain which Hillary Clinton ran on unsuccessfully. Then we'll get an assessment of why South Africa's President Jacob Zuma has faced 6 no-confidence votes in Parliament and how he dodged the latest bullet in a 189-177 vote, despite mounting evidence of his corrupt ties to the wealthy Gupta brothers. Ambassador John Campbell, a former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria, who was political counselor to the U.S. Embassy in Pretoria during South Africa's first non-racial election and is the author of Mourning in South Africa, joins us to discuss how long the ruling ANC can excuse corruption while clinging to the moral authority bequeathed to them by Nelson Mandela. Then finally, we'll examine the sudden reversal of the Justice Department in withdrawing support for a case before the Supreme Court challenging how voters were purged from the rolls in the important swing state of Ohio. Justin Levitt, a professor at Loyola Law School who served as a Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Civil Rights Division of the DOJ, joins us to discuss how much the Trump Justice Department switching to support Ohio's aggressive purging of voter rolls in the middle of a case is tied to the administration's wider efforts at voter suppression via the Kobach Commission. And joining us now is Norman Ornstein, a contributing writer for The Atlantic and a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research. He's an election eve analyst for the BBC and the author of numerous books, most recently the New York Times bestseller, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, co-authored with Thomas Mann, now out in an updated version, It's Even Worse Than It Was. Welcome to Background Briefing, Norman Ornstein.
Thank you, Ian. I actually should tell you about the next book, which is out September 19th, with Tom Mann and also E.J. Dionne, the title of which is One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported, which will fit very nicely into our conversation today.
Right. But it makes the assumption that there is a post-Trump America. And with today's remarks about North Korea in the face of an incredibly explosive situation with a highly unstable regime, where the Secretary of State recently made very imaginative and mature approaches suggesting that we may be not interested in regime change. He's obviously trying to reach out with an olive branch, and this he gets undercut, and this all explodes in our face. I mean, we have a president who's playing with fire.
Of course we do. And when you said with an extremely unstable regime, I wasn't sure whether you were talking about North Korea or the United States at this point. We have a president, I'll be blunt, who is a 71-year-old lifelong narcissistic sociopath who also has almost no knowledge base and almost no impulse control. And when you're dealing with that kind of situation and confronting North Korea, it's explosive. And if you have a president feeling under intense pressure as the investigation of his behavior, not just with Russia, but clearly going back to a number of his other financial dealings, some of which are with Russian oligarchs and gangsters, perhaps, with grand juries convened, you know, you have to be even more concerned about policies that might be taken that are not done with necessarily the long-term best interests of the country and its national interest at heart.
So do you think that we have false comfort in the idea that there are some adults in the room? I'm not sure that Mattis, McMaster, and now General Kelly are in fact in the room. You seem to see more of Bannon and more of Sebastian Gorka, who is, by all reasonable definitions, a Hungarian fascist. I mean, these people are dangerous, I think.
One of the things that has happened, at least since General Kelly came on board, and I'll preface that by saying that General Kelly has not distinguished himself as a balanced figure as the head of the Department of Homeland Security. The policies that he's pursued and condoned by his ICE agents have really been more than troubling. But Kelly moving to the White House, one of the first things that he did was to give a lot more rein to McMaster to begin to purge the place of some of the previous Flynn people who are themselves both inexperienced and without policy views that any of us would feel comfortable and safe with. They're not all gone, and Sebastian Gorka remains a major figure. And of course, now that Kelly has given McMaster the ability to get rid of some of these people who are continuing to stick around, we're seeing the right, including clearly heavy emphasis by the Russians with bots, going after McMaster in a big way. We know that Trump has tepidly given his support to his national security advisor, but we also know that the national security advisor, who's a sane and rational person, has not been in the room with meetings with Putin, with meetings with other foreign leaders. And we have to worry about who will be there when the president makes some of his decisions. But it's also a question about whether General Mattis, General McMaster, or the others around him will go along with those things without some strenuous pushback.
Well, I find it a little surreal that you have the Attorney General, who himself has been humiliated and insulted by his boss, be sort of stepping up to the plate and talking about how he's going to go after leakers and Trump himself, of course. When he said that he was annoyed or disappointed in Sessions, it's said that he's been very weak on intel leakers. I mean, isn't it a bit extraordinary to have a situation where you've got a government that is under suspicion, at least a president and his close circle, and particularly his family, under suspicion of colluding with the Russians, and all of this focus on leaks, including the most recent one, which was, of course, revealing Trump's appalling lack of knowledge, experience, and any kind of sense of diplomatic behavior in these crude and ignorant transcripts of his discussions with the Mexican and Australian leader. Now, everybody says, and they're quite right, that there should be a certain level of privacy that presidents have. But on the other hand, the person who leaked that and the people that keep leaking from this leaking sieve of a White House, clearly, surely, they seem to be motivated by an alarm, trying to tell the American people, this is who you have elected.
And, you know, I think you focused on a lot of the right things. It makes me uneasy to see leaks of private conversations between world leaders, because future presidents are going to be more careful about what they say to world leaders. But certainly the substance of these leaks and the earlier stories that we heard are extremely alarming. You know, the conversations about Sessions, the sliming of Sessions by the president, basically furious because Sessions had done what was exactly the appropriate thing to do, having been involved deeply in his campaign and having lied to Congress about having met with Russians. If he had not recused himself from the Russian investigation, it would have been an absolute scandal. That tells you something about Trump's mindset to begin with. And then when you talk not just about leak investigations, but about dragging journalists in and changing the rules there, you're really seeing some of the elements of an autocratic mindset that are themselves troubling. And I'll tell you, when I look at a Congress that's decided that there should be a higher priority on investigating Hillary Clinton 8 months after the election and not looking at collusion with Russia, or even more, the obvious stepped-up Russian efforts to undermine American democracy and to steal our secrets, that shows you that the unease shouldn't just be about Donald Trump. It should be about others who are enabling him and not providing the kinds of checks and balances that the system is supposed to provide.
But if these Russian troll farms are still spewing out bots that are helping Trump and going along with the way that he's solidifying his base, then this has hardly stopped. I mean, clearly he's alarmed at what's happening with this, with Mueller, and he's made it quite clear that he'd like to fire him, and he's annoyed with his attorney general because he didn't fire him. I mean, this is not the behavior of an innocent man. There's something there that's troubling him, whether it's Mueller having hold of his tax returns. But just to pull back a bit and look at this in the historical context, have we ever had a president, even a senior official in any government in the history of this country, that could be suspected of treason? I mean, this is at the heart of this allegation, or this allegation of collusion, is the possibility that either you have a honey trap, a money trap, or something that Putin is holding over Donald Trump. Now, of course, it hasn't been proven, but the mere fact that it's out there and it's clearly bothering him is just so unprecedented, and it seems to my mind dwarf everything. I mean, I don't see how you can go after leakers when you ought to be able to come clean to the American people and reassure us that you're not some kind of Manchurian candidate.
So let's throw in a couple of other elements here. We have a Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, who has announced that he will not spend $80 million appropriated by Congress explicitly to fight Russian cyber attacks and ISIS cyber use. Then you throw in the fact that Medvedev, the number two leader in Russia, did a tough tweet about the weakness of the Trump administration when it signed the president let through the new sanctions bill. And we got nothing, no response from Trump. But when he's on his, as he says, working vacation at his Bedminster Country Club, and it's a rainy day so he can't be out there playing golf, and he insists that he's working hard, within a few minutes after Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal appeared on CNN, Trump issued a storm of tweets ripping Blumenthal, who served in the military, for having lied about his having been in Vietnam. So he's attacking almost everybody else who even touches on him, but doesn't give a single word about Russia, even when a Russian leader attacks him. All of that is just bizarre, and it's hard to find another explanation except that he is, in some fashion, in league with, in thrall to, or maybe being pushed by, for nefarious reasons, Putin and the Russian regime. The good news here is that Mueller has assembled an extraordinary team of people. At least some Republicans in Congress are backing up Mueller, and it is there's a pretty good chance we'll get to the bottom of some of this, except that along the way, Trump may do some things that are really difficult, troubling, dangerous, destructive, over the line, and we have to be on guard.
But why then does Trump's base not see the obvious here when he attacks Blumenthal, who did obviously had he had academic or educational deferments during the Vietnam War and eventually joined the Marine Reserves. And on a couple of occasions, apparently, he conflated serving in the Marines during the Vietnam War with being in Vietnam. And he's apologized profusely for that. Donald Trump, on the other hand, had educational deferments, and then he got a deferment finally because of a bone spur. He went on the Howard Stern show to brag about how he got out of Vietnam, and his Vietnam was the contracting venereal disease from all of his many sexual partners as he was celebrating on the home front. Why do his supporters? I mean, we saw what it did to George W. Bush and what it did to Bill Clinton. This Vietnam business does hang over a lot of people of that generation. But this guy has skated, and I don't for the life of me understand why.
So let me try and put it into a frame that I think fits. Keep in mind first that our politics have become increasingly tribal. And we tend to view our tribal leaders through a different lens or prism than others do. Our politics are driven by negative partisanship, which means you are less attached to the positive side of what your own party identification represents and more to a fear and loathing of those people in the other party who are hell-bent on destroying America's way of life. Now, throw into that a kind of media mix now where most people, or lots of people at least, cocoon in and hear only what they want to hear. And then watch, and you see a lot of this actually on Twitter, of people who are monitoring the three cable news networks and point out that whenever there is news, for example, about Russia or Russia's collusion, stories about Michael Flynn or Paul Manafort or Jared Kushner or Donald Trump Jr. that are dominating CNN and MSNBC, Fox is running a story about Hillary Clinton. So for Trump, who has cultivated this base, and it's filled with lots of people who believe that elites in America have viewed them with contempt in some cases, and in other ways that the Democrats are an evil, awful collection of people, any criticism of Trump redounds to the benefit of the people you hate the most. And so there is a rallying around effect and a psychological impact here. Now, many of our pundits have been wrong in the past in believing that that core for Trump was not going to change and that it was around 40% or even a little bit more. And then it was around 38%. Well, now we have surveys suggesting his approval is around 33%. And even that could erode a little bit, especially as he indicates his willingness to sabotage what exists in the healthcare system in the Affordable Care Act. And out of spite, has talked about blowing it up. People who benefit from that, and that includes a lot of older voters and a lot of working poor people, but also plenty of middle class people who, for example, rely on Medicaid for nursing home care for themselves or their parents or grandparents. Some of this may erode even a little bit further. But the more he cultivates that base, while refusing to try and reach out to a broader audience, as every other president has tried to do, the more they get determined in their support for him, because abandon that support and you're in effect giving aid and comfort to the enemy. And that means he may last a little bit longer. It means more intimidation for Republicans in Congress, because his base is their base too in primary elections. He's got support from some billionaires who could come after them in primaries or provide a lot of support for them through unpopular policies. But of course, it also means a much, much greater division in the country that is extremely destructive.
Well, just in closing, could it work? Could there be a method to his madness? In other words, it is puzzling, yes, that he keeps throwing red meat at his base and that it is shrinking and that a lot of more traditional Republicans are finding it insupportable and unsustainable to make excuses for this compromised president who's manifestly incompetent. could you use, for example, Sinclair and Fox and Hannity and Boris Epstein and all of these characters in a Putin-like distortion of reality and with a propaganda blitz along with Kobach's commission to strip people from the roles? Yeah. I mean, is there a way that a combination of anti-democratic and Soviet propaganda means could be enough to sustain him, because there really isn't any democratic opposition that I can identify.
You've got, I think, a key point here, that if you combine the support from billionaires and very wealthy people, a lot of which is with the expectation that they're going to get a gigantic tax cut, with a media that in many ways now resembles a fairly large state-run media, not just like what Putin has, but also like what, for example, Erdogan now has. And you combine that with the way in which he is getting this base to move even more firmly on his side, and put that together with the fact that as Republicans in Congress inch away from him, they face enormous blowback from a good part of their own core. And look at how, for example, the book that Jeff Flake has just done, harshly criticizing Trump, a courageous thing to do when he's up for re-election next year. But his approval rating at this point in Arizona is 18%. And that's not likely to encourage a lot of other Republicans in Congress who are appalled by Trump to move beyond an occasional tut-tut, we don't like this behavior. But if we get into more and more dangerous territory, territory that could really threaten the fundamentals of the country itself, then we'll see some moments of reckoning. And we simply have to hope, especially in the Senate, I think the House is a much harder body to feel optimistic about, that a lot of people who care, to use Lindsey Graham's phrase, about country above party, will begin to rise to the occasion. Those moments of reckoning are yet to come.
Well, just to go back to our original opening remarks about this North Korea crisis, which is getting worse because Donald Trump is throwing gasoline on a very combustible situation. We may even be there before, sooner than later. I thank you for joining us, Norman Ornstein.
My pleasure, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Norman Ornstein. He's a contributing writer for The Atlantic and a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research. He is an election eve analyst for the BBC and the author of numerous books, most recently the New York Times bestseller, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, co-authored with Thomas Mann. Now, in an updated version, It's Even Worse Than It Was. His forthcoming book out soon is One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back getting an assessment of why South Africa's President Jacob Zuma has faced six no-confidence votes and how he dodged the latest bullet.